You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
Have you been naughty or nice?
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual...
Consider the fairy lights. There's a reason we hang strings of fairy lights this time of year. And that is their name, by the way. That's what they're called, fairy lights. And if you don't believe me, go search fairy lights on Amazon. But please don't buy your fairy lights on Amazon. Buy artisan small batch fairy lights from your local mom and pop fairy light shop, like we did. We actually bought our LED fairy lights on Amazon. Anyway, there's a reason we hang strings of fairy lights this time of year. And there's a reason we put them on our fire escapes and on the bushes in our front yards and not in our bedrooms or basements. There's a reason we put our Christmas trees and menorahs in our front room windows. Hell, there's a reason why the CTA, the Chicago Transit Authority, puts lights on a train and sends it all over the city on the elevated tracks and not through the subways. It's the same reason ancient peoples built bonfires on hilltops on the longest, darkest night of the year. We put lights in our windows and on our elevated trains. We put our Christmas trees and menorahs in our front room windows to send a message to our friends and neighbors and strangers, to our social solar systems. A message that says, better days, brighter days are coming. You just gotta hold on. There's a lot we are holding on for as 2020 comes to an end. We're holding on for sunnier days. We're holding on for a new president. We're holding on for immunity. We're holding on and continuing to wear our masks as more and more people get vaccinated. We know there are still dark days ahead, politically, biologically, cosmically. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It has been a hell of a year, and we've got more hell to get through. But the lights remind us that we're all in this together. We can, of course, do more than hang lights. I do think the lights help. I think both putting them up and seeing them meet deep-seated human needs. But we can help out in other ways. People need more than light. People can't eat light. We just made a donation to Northwest Harvest, which supports food banks all over the Pacific Northwest, where we live. If you're in a position to donate, particularly to a food bank right now where you live, if you can help, please do. And if you need help, please ask. Give someone the gift of being the light you needed to see. Okay, coming up on today's show, comedian, actress, author, and newly minted podcaster Sarah Silverman comes back on the show. We talk about life, love, being friends with your exes, and starting a podcast. We talk on the micro, and Sarah sticks around for the Magnum to answer some of your sex questions with me. If you're not already a subscriber to the Magnum Lovecast, this would be a good week to subscribe at savagelovecast.com. Twice as much show, more guests, more Sarah, more questions, and no ads. And the Lovecast makes a great gift. All that coming up on today's show. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by omgyes.com, a website devoted to women's pleasure. Check it out and get a discount when you go to omgyes.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Calm, the number one app for meditation and sleep. For a limited time, my listeners get 40% off a Calm premium subscription by going to calm.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Talkspace, online therapy that makes it easy to get extra mental health support. For $100 off your first month, go to Talkspace.com and use the offer code SAVAGE.
Hi, I have a success story for you. My partner has a niche kink for all of your curious listeners. It's drool and spit, but he has trouble finding porn within that realm and to his liking because it's often mixed with piss play and other things that aren't really to his taste, and it's just straight drool and he has a hard time finding it. So I try to provide him with the occasional homemade porn of me drooling in various sexual scenarios so he can build his own personal collection. So one night when we were together, I asked him if he wanted to film me on his phone while I drooled and while I also got myself off. And this was not a hard pitch to sell him. So he moved to the end of the bed, and he filmed me as I pleasured myself and drooled while he slowly jacked himself off while recording. We were positioned perfectly so we could both watch each other's masturbation, which was really hot, making eye contact and then moving our eyes back to other various parts of each other's bodies. After I had climaxed, I asked him how the video turned out, and he asked if I wanted to watch it together, which was also not a hard sell. So he moved back up to the top of the bed, and we cuddled up next to each other and watched while I took a turn, slowly giving him a nice hand job. And after we watched me finish climaxing on screen, we put the phone down, and he gave me a few more orgasms in various ways before he took his own turn climaxing himself. So we have a lot of great sex, but this was definitely a uniquely and memorable moment.
Thank you for calling and sharing your sex success story. We like to start each week's show with someone's success story before we get to everyone's problems. If you want to share your success story, give us a call, 206-302-2064, and we might open next week's Lovecast with your story.
Hi, Dan. Long-term listener here. Gay, 28-year-old male living in Washington, D.C. Recently, a guy that I've been interested in since 2016, actually, let me know after months and months and months of us chatting back and forth and trying to make plans to have our first date and hang out and try to establish a relationship together, that he had tested positive for herpes. Now, I'm very sex positive. I don't shame people for STIs, but my immediate thought was, oh no, what am I going to do now? I'm really interested in this guy. I want to date this guy. I want to fuck this guy. But he has herpes. And as we all know, once you get herpes, you have it for the rest of your life. If you were me, what would you do next? I've already told him I don't judge you. I'm okay with this. But deep down, I'm really concerned because I don't want to contract herpes. And then let's say our relationship doesn't work out, and then I have to live with that the rest of my life, disclosing it to future partners and potentially negatively affecting my love life.
If I were you, here's what I would do. I would dig into the Savage Love archives and look for every episode we've ever done with a medical expert, a guest expert from Planned Parenthood, where we talked extensively about herpes, which in most cases in the lives of most people who are infected is really not that big a deal. A minor skin condition. Unpleasant when there's a breakout, particularly unpleasant usually at the first breakout. But most people who have herpes don't know they have it. That's how minor an issue herpes often is in the lives of most people who are afflicted with the scarlet H. So I would encourage you just to calm down, or as I said, just dig into the archives, listen to those shows that we've done with doctors from Planned Parenthood, and take a deep breath. You're an openly gay man in Washington, D.C., which is a city crawling with homos. In the last 4 years, as a sexually active gay man in Washington, D.C., I ask you this in a sex-positive, slut-positive way. How many guys have you slept with since 2016 when you first became interested in this guy? If you are like most out sexually active gay men in Washington, D.C., over the last 4 years, single out sexually active gay men in Washington, D.C., perhaps even partnered out gay sexually active men in Washington, D.C., you've probably slept with more than 5 other guys, more than 10 other guys, more than 20, 25, 30. What is your body count, as the kids say? Statistically speaking, if you've gone to bed with, say, 10, 20 guys, you have crawled into bed with numerous men who have herpes, who had it and didn't know it, or who had it and didn't disclose to you that they had it. It seems to me that you're at less of a risk of contracting herpes from this guy, and you may have already been exposed to herpes multiple times. You may already have herpes, even if you've never had an outbreak or an outbreak that you noticed. But it seems to me you are at less of a risk from this guy, particularly if he's on meds, particularly if you're planning to use condoms initially at first when you start getting together, you are less of a risk from this guy than you were from those other guys that you have almost certainly slept with who had herpes and didn't tell you because they didn't know or didn't tell you because they feared exactly this kind of rejection, this fear of herpes that exists out of all proportion to the impact herpes has on the lives of most people who have it. There are very effective treatments that can really limit or eliminate any chance of an outbreak should you contract herpes. And if he's on those meds, the odds that he will infect you, particularly if you're using condoms, are very low. If you like this guy, I think you should go out with him. Obviously, he's comfortable having this conversation, or he's trying to get comfortable having this conversation. So I'd encourage you to ask him about the frequency and severity of his outbreaks. I would encourage you to ask him what medications, if any, he's taking to suppress his outbreaks and make him less infectious to his sex partners, and what his plans are or intentions are or preferences are around condoms and other safe sex practices. But I wouldn't not date this guy if I were you. I would date this guy. I would see this guy. The fact that he was honest with you about this speaks well of him. Sleep. We all love it, and most of us probably want more of it. I know I do. But rather than getting a solid night's sleep, we often find ourselves, I know I find myself in bed, scrolling through social media or reading the news when we should be powering down for the night. That's why we're excited to partner with Calm, the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories narrated by soothing voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, and Laura Dern. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and help them get better sleep. Get the Calm app and experience a transformation in the way you sleep. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/savage. That's calm.com/savage for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library with new content added every week. Get started today at calm.com/savage. That's calm.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 30-year-old gay man living in the Midwest. I've been dating a guy for about 9 months, and it's been going great. However, the giant elephant in the room is that he may have to relocate for work. He's part of a program where he has relocated to different offices around the country. That's actually the reason why he came to the city. He gets to rank where he wants to go, with the possibility of even staying here. However, it's ultimately up to the company where he will go. He finds out where he will go in 6 months, but won't have to move for a year. My question to you is, how do you know when you're ready to move for your partner? I have honestly never considered living in this city. I was born and raised here, and all my friends and family are here. It seems a little premature to be talking about it, having only been together 9 months and never having lived together. But really, if I were to relocate, I would have to start making arrangements with my work and whatnot fairly soon. Also, if I knew I was not going to be ready to relocate in 6 months or a year, I also don't want to waste our times and kind of just want to pull the plug. So, I don't know. I guess what I'm asking you is, how do you know when it's right to move for your partner?
You describe this possible move that your boyfriend might have to make as the elephant in the room. Seems to me that you're making this into an elephant, you're blowing this up into an elephant, that you're inflating whatever it is that's in the room and calling it an elephant after it gets big enough. He might not have to move. He could end up staying right where you are, right where you two met, right where your family and friends still are. And it's going to be 6 months till he finds out if he has to move, and then a year from now before he has to move. That's a long time when you're talking about a relationship that's only 9 months old. And you may at 9 months not feel ready about moving with him if he should have to move. And at a year and a half, be sure that moving with him and for him would be something that you were anxious to do, ready to do, something you wanted to do. So unless you're casting around looking for an excuse to end this relationship now, unless you want out of it, and this is your excuse to end it, don't make the decision now that you don't have to make now. Make it later. And in the same way, early in a relationship, it can feel premature to say I love you, but not premature to acknowledge that you might be feeling like you want to say that. It's not premature to talk about moving right now with him, but it's premature to make any decision. You don't have to make a decision now. Something might come up in the next couple of months that ends the relationship, where you decide you don't want to be with him, even if he was going to stay put for the rest of his life. So stop gaming this out. Stop looking a year into the future and making predictions about how you're going to feel or whether or not you're even going to be with this guy. And you don't need to start making preparations to move with him. If a year from now he has to move and you still want to be with him, you can at that point begin to make the preparations with your work for you to move, and then do the long distance thing for 6 months. Where you see problems that have to be addressed and resolved right now, I see things that you can address and perhaps resolve a year from now, a year and a half from now, if you're still with him a year and a half from now. So don't panic right now. Just enjoy your new relationship. And then 6 months or a year from now, you can make a decision about whether you want to follow him, whether you want to do the long distance thing for 6 months or a year, or do the long distance thing indefinitely until his company moves him again and perhaps possibly moves him back to where you are. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Oh My God, Yes. Imagine what cooking with someone would be like if there weren't words for things like fry or salt or bowl or whisk. One result of the taboo and silence around sexual pleasure is a lack of words. And you can't use your words if you don't have your words. That's where Oh My God Yes comes in. Oh My God Yes's large-scale research in partnership with Indiana University and Yale researchers found that most of the specific ways of touching that are sexually pleasurable for women don't even have names yet. As author and Savage Lovecast guest Peggy Orenstein said, there's no better way to make something unspeakable than to not name it. One of the main benefits OhMyGodYes.com users report is having more words for what they like after using the site. It's trippy to recognize something that you really like but hadn't even formalized in your head before. Like how broad pressure on the clit with a palm instead of a fingertip can give bigger, softer pleasure, or ways to hold a partner's body against you during penetration so they stay inside and rock instead of jackhammering in and out, or when a fingertip stays just barely inside the anus before orgasm. Come and see the surprising wide range of what feels good at OhMyGodYes.com and find new words for your own or your partner's pleasures. It can powerfully improve your sex life and empower you to try things, ask for things, adjust things, and combine things. Oh My God Yes makes a terrific holiday gift, and Savage Lovecast listeners get a special discount at omgyes.com/savage. That's omgyes.com/savage. We're going to take a quick break from your calls to speak with comedian, actress, and now podcaster. Welcome back to the show, host of the Sarah Silverman Podcast, Sarah Silverman. Hey, Sarah, congratulations on your new podcast. I've been binging it and loving it. It's a terrific medium for your sensibilities, your comic sensibilities. Congratulations. Welcome to the podcast side.
Dan, thank you so much. I'm having a lot of fun.
So for people who haven't yet had a chance to check it out, haven't heard about it, what are you doing with your podcast? What are they going to find there?
Pretty much it's I solicit voicemails, much like somebody I know. And I kind of, the night before, we pick a few and to play. And I just kind of let that be the trajectory of the show. And it seems to go as quickly as, you know, you think you have nothing to say in therapy. And then the next thing you know, your 50 minutes are up.
Oh my God, that's so true. Or nothing to say in my experience, the confessional when I was a Catholic school kid. And then,
oh my gosh,
you know, 6 hours later, you're still there.
Yeah. 1,000 Hail Marys later.
Yeah, right. I sometimes fantasize about going back to confession because I haven't been to confession for 30 years. And forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 30 years since my last confession. Hope you packed a lunch because we're going to be here for a while.
You know, Bill Maher used to have a classic joke about being half Catholic, half Jewish, and he'd go to confession and say, "Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. I'm sure you know my lawyer, Mr. Goldberg."
The show, it's different. Is it different than doing stand-up?
Very different for me, because I mean, although it kind of fills the same void, it you know, with stand-up, I think I give off a sense of you know, I'm hopefully you're in the moment when you do stand up, but in terms of my material, I'm a very slow, intricate honer over a long period of time. And the thing I love about the podcast that's so different from what I do in stand up is, and the frustrating thing as well, is that it's so immediate, so loose, so messy. And, you know, I'll listen back and go, oh, I could have said that so much clearer, so much cleaner, you know, so much less circumlocutively. Mm-hmm. Gee, mm-hmm. That's not a word. But, you know, because over time with comedy, I economize and boil things down, and every little word is kind of given thought.
It brings up something funny about audience expectations. Because, you know, when you go to a comedy club or you watch a stand-up, a comedian special on Netflix or HBO, you want polished and tight. But the audience that comes to a podcast kind of wants something looser and more informal and conversational. They want that messy quality. I've listened to podcasts that are really polished, that are really scripted, and I always find them off-putting. But if I watch, you know, a stand-up special and it's a digressive mess and not very funny, not tight, I don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, you can even tell with your calls, yours and mine as well, when people have written down exactly what they want to say and just kind of read it, as opposed to when they call in and really just like talk from their core, you know, it's different.
I wanted to ask you about some of your political activism. I loved your show, I Love You America, and I miss it. And on it, you did a lot of reaching out to sort of red state people, Trumpy people. And you made these personal connections and showed them Hollywood liberals aren't monsters, and showed fans of Hollywood liberals that they aren't monsters. And it's great content. But does it work? Do you think it works? Do you think anyone that you've had these interactions with and made these connections with voted any differently in November?
Gee, I don't know. But I at the very least left them more open, and I left more open. Listen, I'm not open to Trumpism, you know, but I just have always seen a big difference between, you know, and I've said this a lot, the liars and the lied to. Mm. You know, I have no time, patience, or space in my heart for liars. I would if they didn't affect people's lives and make decisions on behalf of so many people based on their own unexamined lives.
Right.
But for citizens just going about their own, albeit unexamined, lives, I have more compassion and I feel more connected to. And, you know, putting on that show, you know, I put them in a position where they were my host, where I was in their hands. I was in their space. I didn't know anyone around me. I had no source of food unless they fed me. You know what I mean? Like, it was, and when somebody now is in a position to take care of you, they can love you. You know what I mean? And I felt the same way. You know, I didn't leave any of those people feeling anything but care. You know, mm-hmm. You exchange gesture. You know, this is real. This is different from the podcast, but this is, you know, it was more about like, we found that we were exchanging gestures of care, to use Mr. Rogers speak, you know, and it changes everything. I mean, when you're face to face with someone, it's just totally different.
But the hope is it changes how they vote. Like that's at the base of it. You know, there's been all this discourse on the left since Trump's victory 4 years ago that we need to reach out. We need to understand, blah, blah, blah. They never need to reach out. They never need to understand. We need to reach out. We need to understand. And I am all for compassion. I'm all for connection. But just sometimes I wonder about the utility of it. I've had interactions with real conservatives. Like, I've done some reporting. I followed Mike Huckabee around in 2008. And I had these interactions with people who were so nice to me. And like, we bonded over stuff. Like, I remember talking to this one woman about our kids, right? And she set aside the like cocksucker thing, but the parent thing, the parent thing obscured the cocksucker thing long enough for us to really get along. But, you know, at the end of the day, because I did circle back and check in, you know, and then my visit there in Arkansas, she still thought I should be locked up. She still thought I shouldn't be allowed to marry. She still thought my kid should be taken away from me. More in sorrow now than in anger, but still. And I, you know, sometimes I'm just like, does it do any good? Or should we all, you know, just stop reaching out, stop bothering, and just get out there and register voters who might agree with us, a la Stacey Abrams in Georgia?
Well, of course. I mean, if you're deciding between one or the other, yeah, go work, you know, work with Stacey Abrams. Like, if you have the capacity to do both, or if you, you know what I mean? Do both. Nobody's, listen, it's kind of like with Black Lives Matter, the kind of thing of like, not expecting people of color to explain to you their existence and what their lives are like and what, you know, it's like, Google it, read a book, you know, that kind of thing. But it is a gesture of care to say, all right, yeah, no, this is what it's like, or we, you know, just taking that example, you know, it's just above expectations kindness. It can't be expected. But I do think, you know, and you say, well, we're supposed to reach out, but they're not. Yeah, we don't have to. No, you're not beholden to do any of those things. But I believe there are benefits to doing it if you have the space for it. And I think it even creates more space.
I completely agree with you. You know, I reject folks who say I shouldn't have to explain. I sometimes argue with folks who say, you know, I shouldn't have to explain gay stuff to you. You should go do the read. I'm like, no, I shouldn't have to explain what being trans is about to you. Well, actually, it might benefit you as a trans person to explain what being trans is about, because telling people to do homework, that's not going to, that there's no progress that's going to be made there. And who knows, maybe that woman that I reconnected with like 6 months later, hadn't changed her position on whether I should be thrown in jail where the gay sex stops. But maybe 2-3 years later, she came around. Maybe you planted a seed. Just like our families, you know, we come out to our families if we're queer, and they might not react the way we'd hoped initially. Maybe it might take a year or two for them to come around. But people can come around, can ultimately resolve their cognitive dissonance around what they've been taught to believe about you and what they're actually going to think going forward.
Right. There are not guarantees, but it's, you know, you have to decide if it's worth it. I mean, just like with our parents or, you know, anything in what we learn as we get older is, you know, we can't necessarily change other people. We have to just change ourselves. So you need to just not be gay. No. So, you know, like, right. Whether it's changing your expectations of others or, you know, stopping setting yourself up for disappointment, you know, with friends or with family, it's the same thing, you know, but to at least understand that whether we like it or not, we're all connected, you know, and that can be, you know, a good thing, and it might not.
Speaking of connections, I want to kind of shift gears and talk about some stuff that comes up on my dumb podcast a lot. You're really public about doing something. You're really public about having done something I'm always encouraging people to do. And I'm not talking about pegging. I'm talking about being friends with an ex.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah, you're talking about being friends with an ex. I'm very pro-pegging if people want to peg, but I'm not a pegging evangelist. I don't think people who don't want to peg should peg. But you're friends with an ex, with Jimmy Kimmel. People often have a hard time sticking the dismount there, being friends with an ex after the relationship, or circling back and becoming friendly, or being friends, you know, at some point in the future, even if you can't hang out for a while. How did you do it? And what advice do you have for people who want to be friends with an ex?
You know, Silverman girls just always keep their exes. I don't really understand how you stop loving someone, you know, unless it was like really, really dark stuff, you know, but it just kind of changes. I mean, you know, Jimmy's like a brother to me, but yeah, do I have frustrations, anger, bitternesses? I'm sure, you know, but when I think of him or if I see him pop up on TV, I just go, oh, you know, I mean, I don't, I think the key is being responsible for your happiness right now, you know? And, you know, I mean, like Jimmy is, you know, I mean, we've been not together much longer than we were together. And it was for me, I think for both of us, a big, you know, relationship. But, you know, what you do, I think, is you take your lessons from the relationship. You try to become really aware of the things you don't want to repeat from it. And it doesn't have to be necessarily about blame as about like how you are going to change moving forward. But I mean, I would say like all of my exes, and there's a lot, you know, I adore, you know, I mean, I have good taste. I like these people, you know, I mean, listen, our regular friends are people who have been awful in relationships, good in relationships, you know, and we love them anyway. You know, I mean, we're not a monolith.
Well, think about family.
Yeah, exactly.
Like what you said about, you know, is there still some bitterness? Is there still some anger, some frustration? Of course there is. And then people will say, well, I can't be friends with my ex because I have some bitterness, anger, and frustration. And yet I think of my siblings. I think of my parents. Like there's always some bitter angerness or frustration, but I still love them. You're stuck with your parents and siblings in a way, perhaps with their family. You're not stuck with your exes. You can, I mean, there are some people who have to, you know, shove toxic family members out of their life forever, but most people sort of like make do and like focus on what's good and positive. And if you can do that with an ex, and of course, nothing about what I'm saying or what you just said, Sarah, applies to emotionally, physically abusive exes or toxic narcissists or anything else like that. There are certainly people who have to be shown the door and never allowed back in your life.
100%.
But if there was love and you grew, even if the ending was painful, like maybe you can, even if you don't want to be around them, appreciate them if you're a better person for having been in a relationship with them. And I always think it's a good sign. I mean, this is something I started writing about sex and relationships 30 years ago, and I was always sort of flabbergasted by in straight land was this idea you could never be friends with an ex. And it was a terrible sign if your ex was, or the someone you were thinking about dating was friendly with their exes. And I always thought that was a great sign. And in gay land, we don't have the luxury of 95% of the population to burn through for relationships or friends. So we tend to be very friendly with our exes. Often we hook up with our exes or hook our exes up with other exes.
Well, I mean, just like in how it's a smaller community, it's like that in comedy. I mean, you know, so many comedians date comedians. I mean, I think more women date comedians. You know, I think male comedians don't, in the heterosexual world anyway, I think there are a lot of guy comics that are just as happy dating a fan from the audience or a waitress. And, you know, a waitress isn't all just a waitress. You know, I don't mean to belittle that. But whereas, like, I think women tend to be more attracted to peers or people they even, you know, look up to. Or, you know, a woman with greatness often wants a partner with greatness, but a man with greatness doesn't necessarily require a partner with greatness. That, I find,
yeah, that
always,
can be a,
not always.
That know. Can be a problem, but it's not just men who do that. Like I hear from women who are very, you know, professional, very accomplished, make a lot of money, who won't date somebody who isn't at least as successful or more successful than they are. And then they bemoan the fact that they're alone, but they won't date the waiter. They won't date, you know, the guy who works in the grocery store. And I think we should be open to that kind of cross-class, cross-educational.
Well, it's like, what is success? Like if a guy works in a grocery store and lives this, the life he, you know, he works in order to fund the life he wants, and the, you know, and besides that, he just loves whatever, you know, the, like the joys of gross national happiness over, you know, gross national wealth.
Sarah Silverman, thank you so much for coming back on my dumb podcast, and congratulations on launching yours during the pandemic. It's terrific. I've just really enjoyed it. It's been a good companion for me on the this side of the pandemic since I started listening a couple months ago. And congratulations.
Thank you
for coming on.
Thank you so much. I love coming on.
Sarah stuck around to help me answer a few of your questions. Those are on the Magnum, which you can find for yourself or give as a gift at savagelovecast.com. More Lovecast, more guests, no ads. You need this. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Talkspace. Right now, we're all full-time workers, chefs, housekeepers, teachers, and babysitters in our own homes. We are trying to keep everyone in their normal routines along with our own, and it is not easy to prioritize yourself and your needs. But your mental health and well-being plays a critical role in showing up as your best self for others. When you need a therapist, as a crisis pops up in your life, it's hard to wait until your next scheduled appointment. That doesn't happen with Talkspace. because you can send and receive unlimited messages with your dedicated therapist in the Talkspace platform 24/7. And an entire month on Talkspace costs about the same amount as a single in-person session. I recommend therapy all the time on this show, and Talkspace is a great way to find a therapist that works for you on your schedule. Talking with friends is great, but it's different to talk with a licensed therapist who has the expertise and knowledge to give practical guidance. Talkspace offers us the support we need at an affordable price. As a listener to this podcast, you get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com or download the app. Make sure you use the code SAVAGE to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's SAVAGE and Talkspace.com.
Hi, Dan. I'm a bisexual woman in her 30s living on the West Coast. I'm calling after hearing a few previous caller stories in the past few weeks that sound similar to mine, and I was wondering what further advice you could give. My husband and I have been together for over 16 years, married for 10, and with one young child. When we first met, he was fairly slim and I was a little overweight, but he seemed not to mind. Fast forward 10 years and we had both gotten a little bit bigger, so I took it upon myself to really get into fitness and exercise, and I lost about 30 pounds. My husband also lost a little bit, but not as much. I'd say my aesthetic goal was similar to an Instagram fitness influencer, lean but not competitive bodybuilding type lean. Granted, at my leanest, I was actually never close to achieving this body goal, but I was feeling pretty good about my body type at that point. But my husband and I started having issues in our relationship, and turns out he hated my newfound love of diet and exercise. He finally admitted to me that he no longer found me attractive, which just crushed my self-esteem. It got to the point where even mentioning how I had plans to go to the gym or do some yoga made him get visibly upset. Keep in mind that the concern that he had was never about me developing an eating disorder or being unhealthy in any way, but just that I was spending too much time at the gym and he didn't like how I looked as a result. We ended up going to couples counseling over it, and the therapist came up with a quote-unquote compromise where he would work out a little bit more and I would work out a little bit less. Shortly after I became pregnant with our son, it was pretty obvious that my husband was really into my big pregnancy belly and the belly that remained after I gave birth. He was constantly telling me how sexy it was, how sexy I was, and so on. During sex, he would reach down and grab my belly or squeeze my sides to help him finish. And while we're cuddling on the couch, instead of hugging or holding hands, he'll reach down and hold my belly. I'm really starting to think that he has a belly fetish. But the problem is that during shelter in place, I've started exercising more since I'm no longer having to commute, and I've managed to lose more, but not all of the baby weight that I had kept on to. And it's noticeable sometimes how affected he is by it. Sometimes he'll give my belly a squeeze, but more like a test to see how fat is still there. And he feels distant or off if he seemingly doesn't like the results. I'm not sure if this is me projecting due to the issues that we've had before, or if I'm analyzing the situation correctly, but I get really frustrated because I feel like he can't be attracted to me unless I remain fat, which is antithetical to my own goals. The way he focuses so much on my belly makes me feel really weird and conflicted about my body. Like he can only be attracted to one part of me or one specific body shape, and if I'm not that shape, then our sex life and emotional connection fall apart. And it's certainly possible that I'll never reach my pre-pregnancy weight or the body type I want, especially as we're planning to have more children in the future, but that I can't even try without risking my marriage is angering and very demoralizing. I'm not even sure how to satisfy his belly fetish if I no longer have a belly.
Your husband needed to lay this kink card down on the table before you got married, before you had kids. He liked your belly. He liked your body as it was when you met, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But if he has a partialism fetish. Partialism is a word that they use to describe someone who has a foot fetish, somebody who has a hand fetish. A particular part of the body really turns them on in a non-normative part, not a part of the body that most other people find attractive. And if a belly, specifically a belly, and a kind of roundish belly is something that he needs in a partner to respond sexually at all, and the disappearance of a belly that had been there is going to result in him withholding his affections or not even be able to respond sexually, that's something that you kind of sort of had a right to know about him and about your belly before you married him, before you had a baby with him, and you're planning to have another baby with him. So while it's tempting to say that in the long run, this is a problem that may resolve itself because you're going to have a big pregnancy belly again, you're going to have baby weight to lose again, there are going to be times in your life when you have a belly, and as we age, we tend to get bellies that stick around forever, you're always going to know in the back of your head that your husband's sexual affections are really conditioned upon your body looking a very particular way. And the question then becomes, is that okay with you? Is accepting his affections under those conditions, with those conditions, is it going to throw you out of sex? Is it going to make you feel objectified, that he doesn't love you for you? He doesn't sexually respond to all of what you bring to the table, not just your belly or the fat on your thighs, but all of you. And so when your belly is flat and when your thighs are skinnier, he's not into you. And even when your belly is fat and your thighs are beefier, even when you're thicker, are you going to be able to enjoy his sexual attentions with that sort of rattling around in the back of your mind during sex? Only you can answer that question to any satisfaction for yourself. Will you be able to suspend your disbelief and enjoy his sexual attentions knowing that they're so conditional? This is a really interesting question because usually it's the opposite. Usually somebody who has a problem with their partner's size or a change in their partner's size, it's about their partner getting bigger or their partner aging and sort of natural changes that happen to all of our bodies over time. And then they stop being able to respond sexually or cruelly withhold their sexual attentions in an effort to manipulate their partner into dieting and exercise. And here you are in really kind of a bizarro world parallel, you know, a negative image of this where you're being manipulated by your husband's withholding ways into not dieting and not exercising. There are a lot of women out there who listened to your question who probably thought, I wish I was in her position. But the irony is that women whose husbands are trying to manipulate them into dieting and exercise are sort of in the same position you're in. You have a manipulative, withholding partner who wants you to look a very particular way and wants to be in a long-term, open-ended relationship with you that involves children and many, many decades, and over time, bodies change. And usually bodies change by getting a little bit bigger and less fit. Your body has changed by getting slimmer and more fit. That change, knowing what we know about the way bodies change over time, unlikely to be permanent. But even when you're bigger again, even when your body is closer to what it was when you first met your husband and it pleases him more, are you going to be all right with that? Is that going to weigh on you? If the answer is yes, that's going to weigh on you. Yes, that's unacceptable. Well, then get in a time machine. Don't have that baby. Don't have another baby. If the answer is no, that's not going to weigh on you, and you can live with it, all right, then stay. Have that next baby. Enjoy your husband's enthusiastic attentions when you have a pregnancy belly again. Maybe take a little bit more time losing the post-pregnancy weight next time. And if there comes a time in your life when you're done with the dieting and exercise, well, then Yahtzee, you know that your husband is going to be really excited about that. But in the interim, it is your body. And you get to do what you want with it. But when you have a partner, doing what you want with your body can impact how your partner feels about you. You know, we are objects. We are attracted to our partners almost invariably first as objects, as visual things, as mass that takes up space. And I think there's a difference between gradual changes that happen over time and changes that we make a decision to actively make. And if you're aware that the changes you're making are something that are going to result in your partner being less attracted to you, maybe that's something you have to take responsibility for. But what's unfair about your particular situation is your husband didn't make this clear to you, that your belly was something that he loved and was really crucial to his ability to respond to you sexually. You need to go to a different couples counselor, I think. Because even if you both know that when you don't have a belly, he's less attracted to you, withholding affection because of the way you look now, that's cruel. That's got to stop. You can live with perhaps the awareness and stuff it down the memory hole and suspend your disbelief to a certain extent about maybe sex being less enjoyable for him when you don't have the belly that you sometimes have. But you can't live with a man who withholds affection in an attempt to manipulate you. You need to separate those two things. He needs to be able to separate those two things. Anyway, I just want to affirm the principle that your body is yours, his body is his. We all get to do with our bodies what we want to do with our bodies. Our partners should celebrate our bodies and accept our bodies, even as they change, whether that means we're getting bigger, whether that means we're getting fitter, whether that means we're getting older. Nobody has the option of getting younger, unfortunately. And people, really, you need to lay your kink cards down on the table before you propose to someone, before you marry someone, and certainly, please God, before you scramble your DNA together with someone. Before we get to your response calls, let's read your tweets. At Vince Under the Stars tweets, listening to the Savage Lovecast about the girl whose friend revealed a secret on a different podcast. How about she casually brings up in small talk the fact that she listens to that podcast? Maybe she tells a little white lie that she's catching up on it so she doesn't put her friend on the spot. Maybe that's some good advice. I don't know if I haven't heard your secret yet, but I soon will is better than I heard your secret. But maybe it is. At Brig B123 tweets, literally laughed out loud during the Savage Lovecast when the voyeur admitted to being hypocritical. And I'm not even a Republican. Glad I'm not the only one who links the two. Thanks for the laughs every week at Fake Dan Savage. You are welcome at Brig B123. And finally, about my response to the bouncer who noticed pre-pandemic that a lot of guys who came to his club were carrying their girlfriend's IDs in their wallets and who thought there might be something sexist or creepy or worse going on. At Alicia KB tweets, my husband carried my ID in his wallet back in the day because I didn't want to carry a purse, just like at Fake Dan Savage said. Nothing sexist or creepy about it. But another listener at Crafty Chicana pointed out that the lack of pockets in women's garments is itself a sexist issue. I think Alicia and Crafty are both right. There's nothing creepy going on with these couples. There is definitely something very creepy and very sexist going on with the culture. And that sexist creepiness exists upstream of the couples the bouncer was carding. The takeaway here, cargo shorts are for everybody. Okay, thanks to everyone who posts about the show to your social media accounts. We do appreciate it. And if you want me to read your tweet on an upcoming episode of the Savage Lovecast, be sure to use the Savage Lovecast hashtag. And now your response calls.
Hi, this is a comment for the girl who was stressing about the friend who was texting her good morning and good night every single day. I would highly recommend that you call that person. There is so much that can be gotten from having a phone call rather than a text message. We tend to just infer all of these meanings and like guess at people's intentions when we are texting back and forth. You know, almost guarantee that if you just gave that friend a quick phone call and said, hey, are these text messages really important to you? Is there some other kind of something that you're getting out of them? Because this is how they occur for me. Having that conversation will A, be a lot quicker over the phone than it will over text message. I know for me, the agony of waiting for a text response is terrible. And so it'll get it over a lot quicker and you will have a much better connection and a much better chance at sustaining the connection that you really want with that friend. So phone call, phone call, phone call.
Hello, this is for the person who said that they got really gassy after having anal sex. I've got a tip for relieving gas. So if you stick your thumb out like you're doing a thumbs up, and then you press your thumb into your lower belly, a bit below your belly button, quite firmly for maybe 10 seconds, then generally I find in a few minutes' time, the gas that might have been like stuck in your system that you weren't able to get out can kind of move through. And it's really helped me when I've been gassy.
Hi Dan, this is in response to the sex success story on episode 738 from a pompous math teacher. The guy on the call talked about the butt plug he is using and referred to it first as having 6 inch in girth and later as having 6 inch in radius. Since 6 inches girth, 6 inches diameter, and 6 inches radius are very different measurements, I guess he was right the first time he talked about girth. He might even have been talking about diameter, but I'm fairly certain he did not mean radius. For comparison, a butt plug with a 6-inch girth will be not quite, but about as thick as a regular 12-ounce can of beer. thicker than pretty much any dick I have ever seen, except maybe once or twice in porn. But I think most people with some practice and some patience and a ton of lube can manage to accommodate something like that. A butt plug with a 6-inch diameter will be as thick as a dollar bill is long. I have not seen that many sex toys that thick, but I think someone with a lot of commitment can work their way up to that. A butt plug with a 6-inch radius would be as thick as a medium pizza is wide in most pizza parlors. I have been in the kink scene for a long time. I have seen people put crazy stuff on their orifices, but I have never, ever seen somebody put something even close to that thick. Probably there are a few people in the world capable of proving me wrong, but I doubt anybody can accommodate something that thick without doing serious harm to themselves.
And we're going to leave it there. Got a question for me or a comment about this week's show? There are two ways to get them to us. You can call us at 206-302-2064, or you can use the Voice Memo app on your phone to record your question or comment and email it to us at voicemail@savagelovecast.com. Tickets are on sale now for Hump 2021 with all new films. We can't watch My Dirty Little Film Festival in theaters this year, but filmmakers have graciously agreed to let us stream their films online. And this year, there are a variety of viewing parties to join, including one with Hump filmmakers and one with me on opening night where we can watch the films together. Go to humpfilmfest.com to look at the variety of dates, times, and viewing parties. There's also still time to make a film for this year's festival. The deadline for submissions is January 8th, so just a few more weeks to grab your friends and lovers that are in your pod and make some homemade dirty movies. Go to humpfilmfest.com/submit to find out all about it. And this holiday season, give the gift of the Magnum. It's twice as long, more guests, more questions, and no ads. Go to savagelovecast.com and click on gift. Please note the subscription goes out right away when you buy it. So if you want it to arrive on December 25th for some mysterious reason, buy it on December 25th. Follow me on Twitter at @FakeDanSavage. Follow Sarah Silverman on Twitter at Sarah K. Silverman. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thank you for downloading.